Good morning, Carl. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm glad to hear your voice. Welcome to A Life in Biography. We're
Thank you
going to
so
be,
much for having me.
oh, thank you. We're going to be discussing your book, Up from the Depths, Herman Melville, Lewis Mumford, and Rediscovery in Dark Times. Going to have to discuss that subtitle for sure.
Excellent.
Before we do that, tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to this book.
Sure. So I teach history and American studies at Cornell University. I've been here for 18 years now. And this book, I have a number of different origin stories for this book, but the sort of most straightforward one is that I started off a big fan of both Herman Melville and Lewis Mumford, but they were completely separate in my mind. Melville, a novelist from the mid-19th century, and Mumford, a very constructive public intellectual of the mid-20th century. And then in 2004, I was at a book sale, a Friends of the Library book sale, my first fall here in Ithaca. And I was in the biography section and I saw a book spine with the names Melville and Mumford on it. And I didn't really know how to interpret that. I didn't know, I would just wasn't sure why they were together. And of course, I discovered that Mumford had written a biography of Herman Melville, and it turned out to be only the second biography ever published of Melville. And so that started me on this path. But I think in a way, the broader question was the question of the Melville revival. People who know Melville know that he was utterly forgotten for several decades. And then his reputation was revived starting in the 1920s, and Mumford turned out to have play a big role in that revival. But it became fascinating to me that that Melville, such a dark writer in many ways, was rediscovered and canonized at this particular moment in the 1920s in America, which, there are many different historical interpretations of the 1920s, but my question was why this match? Like, what did Melville give to people at this particular historical moment?
Yeah, it's a question that fascinates me. Many of the figures that I've worked on, particularly William Faulkner, who was getting his start in the 1920s, I just don't see how Faulkner could have had the impetus to write some of his books without the example of Moby Dick. In fact, he said he wasn't a great one for envying other writers. Faulkner was he never doubted his own greatness,
That's
but
right.
he said if there were one novel he wished he had written, it was Moby Dick.
I know, and what's remarkable is that if Faulkner had started his career, 10 years earlier, probably he never would have even encountered Moby Dick because nobody had heard of it in 1910.
It's really interesting, the whole notion of accident and contingency and who gets interested in who.
But yeah, it turns out, Faulkner, of course, was not alone in his admiration. I say this toward the end of the book, it's actually quite hard to find a modernist writer who did not admire Melville as this kind of strange writer from the mid-19th century who had many, many modernist sensibilities well before the invention of modernism. So yeah, the match is just really, really interesting.
Yeah, the cliche is, a writer or an artist like Melville is ahead of his time, and I think that's true. And I think of it too as writers were in the 20s, the writers do look back. They do have models. They do have mentors in some sense.
Sure.
They found one in Melville. It couldn't have been Emerson. It couldn't have been Hawthorne.
Right.
Not even Twain, really, because Melville, he just has it all. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I like about your book is there is this dark side of Melville, no doubt about it, but there's also a lot of humor.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one of the most modernist things about him is that he's just constantly shifting tone and angle and approach. It turns out to be this sort of mosaic of voices. That was just not really true of other authors at the time. It was very, very experimental. But the one other thing I would just add quickly, and I'm happy to pick up on any of these strands, but even though I completely agree that Melville was ahead of his time, as it were, he was also really deeply engaged in the issues of his time. And that's something that some readings of Melville still tend to miss. You know, he's often discussed nowadays as a kind of timeless, universal genius who just dealt with issues of humanity in general. But in fact, when you start looking into it, you see that he's dealing with issues of race and racism in the 1850s, for instance, or he's dealing with the rise of new labor regimes, seeing the impact that it's having on people to be stuck at desks in offices or benches in factories, that kind of thing. And that was something that Mumford was really, really good at unpacking as well.
It's really hard to find a contemporary issue that you can't find some origin or some sense of it in Melville.
Mm-hmm.
But another way of looking at it is what we consider modern goes back some ways, actually. And Melville helps us to show that, so that, you know, when he's writing about the Civil War or he's writing about Bartleby and Wall Street,
mm-hmm.
and even to think about, you know, current things like working at home.
You know,
and what that means, not having to go into Wall Street, for example.
Right.
That's really important. And these people who are sitting working at home, they might start reading their Melville.
Yep.
Not to mention Mumford. We haven't said, you know, why is Mumford so interested in Melville?
Yeah, I mean, this connects to just what you were saying a second ago. You know, the many trends that we think of as modern are actually much older than we realize. And that was something that really struck Mumford. He was starting to write in the early 1920s. And it was, I mean, this is, again, something that we sometimes forget, but it was, even though people think of the 20s as the roaring 20s, it actually got off to a very, very difficult start that decade. It was the aftermath of World War I. It was the flu pandemic. The times really felt dark to a lot of Americans. And one of the things that American culture did to sort of get beyond those difficulties was to try to emphasize the way in which American society was newly modern. That word itself, modern, really started getting thrown around for the first time in the 1920s. And it was usually used in a celebratory way, like, look how modern we are, look how innovative we are, look at these amazing technologies, look at this economic production we're managing now. And Mumford, in part by reading Melville, but he was really a scholar of the entire 19th century, he started looking back and realizing that a lot of these supposedly new modern trends were really just launched in Melville's era. You know, part of it was just what was what we now call the market revolution, which people trace to the 1830s and 40s. And you can see this in a story like Bartleby the Scrivener. You know, like the market revolution basically just means that everything is suddenly becoming commercial. Every relationship is becoming transactional. So the sort of tension in Bartleby the Scrivener is like, okay, here's this clerk working in a law office and suddenly doesn't want to do the work. What's going to happen? What's that relationship supposed to be? And his boss, many people reading Bartleby the Scrivener focus on Bartleby and his refusal. But I think Melville was actually most interested in the dilemma of his employer, who, you know, was old enough to remember a time when these kinds of relationships were very different. You know, like, well, if you have somebody working on your farm, usually that person is going to live with you, eat with you, almost become a member of your family. Now you've got a clerk working in your office. You pay him to do a certain kind of work. What do you do? How do you think of this relationship, this human relationship? And he has, you know, qualms about it. He's not sure. He feels guilty, but then ultimately the employer, you know, decides, well, I'm in a market society, and I don't owe this guy anything if he's not going to work. And that's the sort of tragedy of the story.
Yeah, you could look at Bartleby as, you know, in some sense a very disturbed character, but his but his employer is also suffering
from, oh yeah,
disturbance, which you've been describing.
Yeah, it's really quite striking. You know, like there's a moment in the story where you think he's going to do the humane thing and just, you know, forget about the business relationship that they have and just try to help this guy who is clearly, you know, Bartleby is clearly suffering some sort of break. But then the power of the market revolution, as it were, is too great. And the other context for Bartleby the Scrivener is Melville is talking about, you know, supposedly free labor, right? This is the kind of labor that we have in the North. Down in the South, it's enslaved labor, and we know that that's horrible. But here in the North, we've got this wonderful different alternative system, free labor, and this story is sort of posing the question, like, oh, really? How good is this system? How free is this labor? You know, what about the hypocrisy of all these Northerners?
Yeah, and just the power of someone dropping out, as Bartleby does, so to speak, the society is not equipped to deal with those feelings.
Right.
Those feelings aren't supposed to enter into business transactions.
Mm-hmm.
It's like people say, you know, it's nothing personal.
Yeah. You just need to do the work. You need to copy that document if I'm going to pay you.
Yeah. You mentioned the farm and the relationship of workers on a farm. And one of the, I think, really interesting things in your book is this oscillation between city and country, both in Melville's life and in Mumford's life. And what that does to their sense of, you know, I don't know what to call it, civilization. You know, how do we cope with the enormous changes that are going on both in the 19th and in the 20th century?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great point. And again, many strands we could follow up on, but. You know, 1920, according to the 1920 census, that's when America becomes mostly urban for the first time. So that's another big part of this sense of modernity in the 1920s that that Mumford is trying to reckon with. And he's looking around and he's seeing, you know, incredible opportunities for human connection and new ideas in cities. This is, you know, this place of, you know, a high concentration of human beings is quite exhilarating in many ways, but he's also seeing overcrowding and pollution and injustice and, you know, a lack of green space. And he's asking, like, is this actually the direction we want to go in? And why is everybody just unthinkingly endorsing the city as the best possible model, especially the way it exists? And, you know, so that's a massive transformation that's happening in the 1920s. But of course, Melville saw it happening back in his day. And it, you know, it turns out, statistically speaking, the most rapid urbanization that this country has ever seen was actually in the 1830s and 40s. So Melville was quite well aware of this and seeing the same kinds of trends. And, you know, from he winds up doing something a little bit different with that dilemma, but just as one example, he thinks of the city as a place where people can actually learn firsthand about the deep injustices of American society and a society that's based on the market. So for instance, just one of his really, really striking, more obscure works is Redburn. And in this book, the main character goes over to England and spends a great deal of time walking around Liverpool. And this is a character who has come from a more rural area in the United States. And in Liverpool, he sees poor people dying in the gutter, and realizes that, you know, the all of the new systems that are being put in place, all of the factories, all of the economic growth that's happening, also has very, very dire costs. And many of these systems are based on exploitation. And you can see that because you're in a big city where, you know, there are many, many people living together, working together, and it turns out dying together. So the city is this sort of dark place, but also a place where you can learn important things about how the world works. And Mumford takes that up as well. And one of the great things about Mumford is that he's an incredible critic of the city. He, you know, really, really attacks the way cities have been either planned or unplanned. But then instead of just saying everybody should try to move to the countryside, he says very explicitly, let's figure out ways of making cities more just, more beautiful, more livable, more humane. He really is the sort of, in some ways, the font of the Green Cities movement.
Well, yes, he has this sense of human scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he realizes he's not against skyscrapers, I don't think. But he realizes that you can't give over the entire urban space to that uniformity of the high towers and the straight streets and all the rest of it. I think that sense of what it means to be human, that some of that's lost. I used to teach at Wayne State University in Detroit in an interdisciplinary program. And we used to, one of the courses I taught dealt with the city and dealt specifically with Detroit. And I used to take my students on a tour of downtown Detroit and
nice.
on foot.
Yeah.
There's a one particular famous building, the Penobscot Building, which is Art Deco, and it's the decorations up and down the building are fascinating to look at. And I said, you know, for those of you who work downtown in downtown Detroit, you drive through the city all the time. And when you do that, you look out your car window. And what your car window is doing is slicing up the city. Mm. You never see the top and you never see the bottom. And you have no organic sense, no human sense of how the city was built, where it comes from, so to speak. And I think my awareness of that, you know, comes from reading Mumford more than anybody else. I think he had such a powerful influence. I encountered him again when I was doing a biography of Jill Craigie, who was the wife of the British Labour Party leader, Michael Foot. Mm. And she met Mumford and he inscribed his books to her. And she did films about, this is after the Second World War, the Labour Party was intensely interested in Mumford.
Yeah.
And trying to get away from, in the 60s, she did a film called Who Are the Vandals? And it's about the Tower Blocks and how dehumanizing they were. And she had these interviews with architects who were clearly inspired by Mumford, talking about how you could still do public housing, mass housing, without, you know, mm-hmm. sending people up in an elevator several stories.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really, really important part of Mumford's legacy, that effort to transform cities. I do have to say he was mostly negative about skyscrapers. He hated the way they blocked out the light, for instance. And he even, you know, that was another thing that he agreed with Melville about. Melville lived in New York City quite a bit, quite a large part of his life, but he also spent some wonderful years living in the Berkshires. And when he first moved to the Berkshires, he said something like, you know, those people living in New York should have mountains as neighbors, to sort of give them a little more humility, because what they seem to be doing in New York is just, you know, trying to build a bigger building than the person next door.
Reminds me of a Robert Frost poem, New Hampshire. The God who made New Hampshire taunted the land with little men. Mumford, I wanted to talk, because I'm a biographer, I'm just fascinated with, there aren't very many books in which are about the biographer and their subjects.
Mm.
Boswell does this, but I mean, he's writing. You're not Boswell. You're someone coming in a sense from the outside and looking at these two men together. And to me, it was, I hoped people would pay attention to this book. And I tried to write my review in the New York Sun in that sense, in seeing biography as that kind of human quest, mm-hmm. that sense of connection. There are so many novels and books like Janet Malcolm's The Silent Woman in which the biographer is the villain.
Right.
And Mumford is certainly not the villain in your book.
No, definitely not. It's exactly the human question that I've always wanted to grapple with. I remember I was a history and literature major in college, and I remember there was this one moment. I was really struggling in my sophomore year, and one of the very few bright moments was when a professor just sort of had a very informal, it was just like a gathering, an afternoon gathering over tea and coffee and cookies. And, you know, there were probably like 10 or 15 students sitting around in a seminar room. And somebody asked this professor why he became a historian. And he just said something like, I'm endlessly curious about the human character.
Mm.
And you feel, you know, like you, when I told the story of finding that biography that Mumford wrote of Melville, and it really is, it's full of that kind of curiosity, you know, like Mumford was a pretty judgmental person, But, you know, in the biography, you really, you find him just sort of expressing this deep fascination with every aspect of Melville, and not feeling the need to judge too much. I mean, certainly there are plenty of evaluative statements in the biography, but you really just get a sense of one person connecting to another person and finding value in this other person's life and work.
Yeah, it's a real surrendering to the subject in a sense, without losing your own sense of the subject, but at the mm-hmm. same time, the role of empathy is so keen.
Yeah, really, really is. And I empathy is another really important key word for me in all the history that I try to do. You know, that sometimes in the training that we academics get, the thing that is emphasized is that you need to have distance from your subject. You need to step back and make sure you don't identify too much. But on the other hand, you also need empathy to try to understand anybody in a different kind of context from the one that you're living in. And I really think Mumford's biography of Melville is absolutely full of empathy. And there's just this, you know, this sense of exploring another person's mind and world that I loved. And so, you know, I made that biography the kind of pivot point of my book, which is really meant to explore both of these people very, very deeply. But I wanted to set up that sense of connection with both of them.
Yeah. Empathy is the right word. And it's sometimes confused with sympathy. Mm-hmm. And it's not even a matter of sympathizing with your subject that is, I understand what you went through. It's more like, why did you do that?
Right.
you know, it's a genuine question. You know, what was he thinking? Why did he do that? I wanted to mention one of the other parallels that you draw so well in your book, and that is Melville dies, and his wife Elizabeth is interested, really wants his story told, and is searching around for a biographer. Mm-hmm. Then is it Sophia or Sophia Melville?
Sophia.
Sophia. Sophia Melville. Also, Donald Miller does write the book, and there's that's a bit complicated. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could talk a little bit about those parallels.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's a book about these two writers, Melville and Mumford, but their wives are incredibly important characters to me, and I try to bring that out in the book, especially toward the end. As you're saying, they both wives outlive their husbands and are left with this question of their husband's legacy. And they both play an incredibly important role in how those legacies got shaped. In Lizzie's case with Herman Melville, you know, the efforts were not immediately successful because the people she tried to get to write about Melville, you know, wound up dropping the ball, and nobody, you know, it just, when Melville died in 1891, most people thought he had already been dead for 20 years. So nobody was that interested. There wasn't much of an audience, as it were, for Melville biography. But she did make sure to keep lots of important papers in the family. And eventually, when the Melville revival started happening, the first biographer was able to track down, his name was Raymond Weaver. He was able to track down some family members and get these documents. And that's how the book Billy Budd wound up getting published, basically because Lizzie had saved these papers in a little tin box and passed them on to her family members. And anyway, those efforts were very important. And then you mentioned the parallel with Sophia Mumford. She was dealing with a fairly young scholar, Don Miller, who had asked to write a biography of Lewis while Lewis was still alive, and had gotten to know both Lewis and Sophia fairly well. But during that time, Lewis was suffering from dementia. It was the very end of his life. And in retrospect, Sophia felt like Lewis hadn't really had the ability to give full consent, but in terms of access to private papers and stuff like that. But he had given consent, and Sophia had given consent, and Don Miller went ahead and wrote what I think is really a great biography of Lewis Mumford. But he included some things that Sophia found somewhat hurtful. And that's, you know, that there's a great danger there with all scholarship. What I wound up getting especially interested in, I don't say too much about this. I wanted to tread lightly, but there are lots of letters and other documents that Sophia saved showing how she was sort of constantly negotiating her relationship with Don Miller as he was finishing the biography, and then once he published the biography of Lewis. And Sophia went back and forth. You know, she there were certain passages that made her really hurt and angry, and she wrote really harsh letters to Don Miller. And then, you know, months later, she would reread the biography that Miller had written, and she would reconsider, and she would write a more conciliatory letter to him. And it was just a very, very interesting, complicated relationship. She wanted Don to be the literary executor for Lewis, and then she rescinded that offer, given her mixed feelings about the biography. But it just, you know, it points to how fraught this kind of work is. You know, it's very hard to work. I'm sure you've thought about this a lot yourself.
Yes.
You know, like the ethics of writing a biography. Obviously, part of your job is to tell the truth about whatever you find. But, you know, I think it's also important to be sensitive to the people who could be hurt by the truth.
Part of what happens too, and I tried to point this out in my review of your book, she lived long enough to come to terms with this. That often doesn't mm-hmm. happen in
yes.
my own experience.
Yeah,
which I briefly describe in the review.
Yeah,
if people don't live long enough to come to, because the first thing is shock.
Right.
You know, as I say in my review. Obviously, married couples have their own treasured sense, if they've been long married, their own treasured sense of what that marriage is like. And yep. then it's inevitable that the biographer, and Boswell used this term, that the biographer is regarded as presumptuous.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's a view from the outside. It's a very different and sometimes even shocking view. And I know in my case, and I'm sure this was true in Miller's case, you talk to all sorts of people and you read all sorts of documents and you read things that married, neither one of that members of that yeah. married couple ever read.
Right.
Or had a chance to think about. You,
yeah.
you have a kind of privileged status mm-hmm. That so that when people attack a biographer, as they often do, well, I know so-and-so and he wasn't like that at all.
Yeah.
Well, that might very well be true.
Mm-hmm.
different, it makes a difference whether Faulkner's writing to his mother or to his publisher.
Sure.
And so you get those kinds of changes. And so I said, I thought that your book was almost a kind of palimpsest, you know, a biography of how it takes generations and years of time, and even to write a book like you did about Mumford and Melville, you can only do that in a sense after people like Miller have done the work, sure. Some of the work of biography, and you can come along, or another writer could come along, and factor in all those different tensions that were always there, but that neither those individuals could quite process, or that the culture can process. It often takes readers of Melville or whoever a long time to accustom themselves to the kinds of perspectives that biographers bring to the subject.
Definitely. And, you know, I was so grateful for all of the scholarship that that I was able to build upon. And like I said, Don Miller's biography is really excellent. It's always that sort of sense of gradual building and trying to take slightly new angles, getting fresh perspectives. And that goes along with the idea that that you referred to, that, you know, all of us are very different people all at once in different contexts. You know, we're different people at work, we're different people at home, we're different people with our family members, we're different people with our friends. And that, I think, you know, that's another goal of any biography is usually to try to show that these people who, you know, it's understandable why we would want to reduce people to some sort of nugget of truth, like this is their character, but in fact, you know, they are multiplicitous always.
It reminds me of a scene in Dickens and of a character Wemmick, who has a little drawbridge. When he comes home, he pulls up the drawbridge and he meets someone quite different.
Yes, that's great. That's a great image.
I'm going to come back to the subtitle, Rediscovery in Dark Times. Mm. I just find that so interesting because a lot of people right now are describing this in this country as a rather dark time.
Absolutely. It certainly feels that way to me. And, you know, we could go on about the, you know, the pandemic and climate change and social divisions and various forms of discrimination and inequality.
And I would just add, even the thought of democracy now, there are people saying, well, this is a republic. It's not really a democracy, right. Which leads to all sorts of political implications. Melville had been very, very interested in and not surprised at, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was really, really interested in the American political system. And we could talk about that more. But in terms of dark times, you know, there are many different angles to this issue as well. But for me, one of the important things is that often in dark times, when people feel like this is really dismal and difficult, their tendency is to look back to earlier times and think of them as a golden era. You know, of course it was much better back then. And one big argument in this book is that it's actually very sloppy to do that. and when you look back from dark times, in some ways, the more important thing is to look back to other times that were experienced as dark and to realize that, you know, even if what we're feeling, you know, seems unprecedented to us in the moment, it's actually not. Human beings, human societies have experienced many, many parallel things. And to me, it's quite, you know, it can be unsettling to realize that. It can be depressing to realize that, you know, human beings have been caught in this horror for a long time. But it can also be really bolstering just to sort of look back and see, yeah, that was really bad back then, World War I, the Depression, World War II. But people lived through it. People came up with new ways of doing things during those dark times. That's a sense to me in which history can be really helpful and constructive, both in terms of specific ways of organizing society and just in terms of boosting morale. People got through it in the past. We're gonna get through it also. There are always alternative ways of seeing things.
Well, Ishmael does come floating to the top.
Absolutely, and that's, one thing Mumford insisted on was Moby Dick has a happy ending.
Yeah.
That like some people, have struggled with that because they say, well, the entire ship went down, everybody died except for one person.
Yeah.
But I think Melville's point, and Mumford took this up, was like these things are going to happen. Ships are going to go down. We are going to have catastrophic losses. That is part of the human condition, and maybe even more so the modern human condition. Many many analysts have described modernity as inherently catastrophic, as well as exhilarating. That's the paradox of modernity. But what matters is the meaning that we make of those catastrophes, those losses. The ship goes down, now what? And the simple fact that there was a survivor who went on to tell the story and to try to take apart the story, analyze the story, interpret the story, make meaning of the story in so many different ways. It's a boost to the human spirit. I mean, like you read Moby Dick, and Ishmael is just such an amazing companion to be with. He is so funny. He has so much energy, even when he's depressed. It really, like, the strange thing about Moby Dick is that as dark as it gets sometimes, you really feel bolstered by reading it. It's just, it's like it's a book that you want to spend time with.
Yeah. Well, even the beginning, call me Ishmael. I mean, call me. I mean, the whole idea of telling a story and assuming a character and so on. It's part of what the biographer does too. I think that's what Mumford is doing with the life of Herman Melville, in a way, because people sometimes think of his life as a disaster, all those years, working on the docks in New York City. But it's a much more nuanced, much more interesting life. That part of it isn't the interest isn't just when he went whaling. It is how he coped with all these other things, not only his writing, but his responsibilities to his family. I've always found it a really moving story, and one that I think biographers are going to tell again and again.
Definitely. And it's so hard to get any sort of grip on Melville. Like he destroyed most of his private papers, and
Yeah.
the manuscript trail is pretty thin. But you've got all of the published work to go on at the very least. And just to pick up on the idea of Ishmael for a second, this is a theme for Melville, like the idea of the biblical Ishmael who feels like an outcast, against whom other people's hands are raised. And if you read Melville's other works, books like Pierre and Redburn and Israel Potter and Clairol, there are constant references to Ishmael. He talks about how all of the main characters in those books feel like an outcast.
Yeah.
And that sense is not, certainly it's a sense that Melville himself had, but I think what's amazing about his literary treatment of that theme is that, it's not simply reduced to an individual phenomenon or a personality. It's not just that somebody feels alienated. It's certainly partly that, but it's also a society that breeds that feeling.
That's part of
the sort of deep feeling of modernity is alienation.
Yeah, I want to put in a special recommendation too for people to read Israel Potter.
Oh yeah,
which I think is a much neglected work, especially when it just slays me when he writes about Benjamin Franklin and John Paul Jones. Because here are two guys who are really on the make, you know, and people talk about the founding fathers, you know, and you know, they have this very august sense of who these people are. And even in the 19th century, Melville is sort of saying, wait a minute.
Yep.
And he's connecting, you know, their politics and their economics in ways that are very, very modern. That really, again, when writers are searching in the 1920s and later for a model, Melville is certainly there, and it explains why Mumford was so attracted to him.
Definitely, the passages about John Paul Jones in particular are quite striking to me in Israel Potter, and the whole, you know, John Paul Jones, this sort of naval hero, turns out to have been, you know, at least in Melville's eyes, just this incredibly violent person.
Yes.
And there are so many funny things in that book also, you know, like Israel at one point serves on a ship instead of the Undaunted or the Unconquerable, his ship is called the Unprincipled. but it's a great recommendation because it's one of Melville's shortest books.
Yes. You know,
it's actually far more accessible than most of his works. It's the only novel that was serialized. It was, you know, he published it right after he had been writing short stories for periodicals for a number of years, and he got really good at that short form. And so the you know, it's like, whereas Moby Dick has, you know, pages and pages of just philosophical asides, and you're not really sure how it connects to the story, Israel Potter has a kind of propulsive pacing. You know, it's just action after action. It's very, very fun, and yet it has that Melville sensibility, that sense of history. The whole book is really a critique of the way that that American culture sort of celebrated the American Revolution. It's like the dark side of the American Revolution in a lot of ways, but it's just like a fun, exciting read at the same time. So yeah, thank you for mentioning that. That's a great one for people to pick up if they're interested in the more obscure Melville.
Yeah. So shall we end on that cheerful note, or is there something else you'd like to say, Aaron?
No, we can end there. That sounds great. There's always more to talk about, but this has been a really wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for all of the thoughts and questions, and for having me on. This was a pleasure.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm going to post this. I will send you a link so that you can send it to whoever you like. I'll put it on Facebook and Twitter and let the whole world know.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Aaron. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.